AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Sartre, October 22, 1964, Paris. Jean-Paul Sartre, the world's most famous living philosopher, is informed that he's been awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. The honor would crown any writer's career, but Sartre does the unthinkable. He refuses it. He tells the press that a writer must remain free, not co-opted by institutions. This shocking gesture is classic Sartre, fiercely independent, committed to radical freedom. To understand why Sartre would turn down a Nobel Prize, we must dive into his life as the embodiment of existentialism and left-wing activism in the 20th century. Jean-Paul Sartre was born in 1905 in Paris. His father, a naval officer, died when Sartre was an infant, so he was raised by his mother in his maternal grandfather's home. As a child, he was small, sickly, and partially blind in one eye, which gave him his signature wall-eyed look. But he was precocious and developed an early love of literature. Sartre studied philosophy at the elite École Normale Supérieure in Paris, where he met Simone de Beauvoir, a fellow philosophy student who would become his lifelong companion and intellectual collaborator. Their open partnership, they never married, became nearly as famous as their ideas. Sartre's early intellectual development was shaped by reading philosophers like Descartes, Kant, and notably the German phenomenologist Edmund Husserl and existentialist Martin Heidegger. In the 1930s, Sartre taught philosophy at a lycée. He also spent a year studying in Berlin, where he delved into phenomenology. These influences brewed in Sartre as he began formulating his own philosophy. World events intervened. Sartre was drafted into the French army at the start of World War II. In 1940, he was captured by the Germans and spent 9 months as a prisoner of war. He used the time to think and outline ideas. Released in 1941, Sartre returned to Paris, which was under German occupation. He resumed teaching, wrote, and involved himself, modestly, in the resistance. It was during the war that Sartre wrote his first major philosophical work, Being and Nothingness, 1943, a dense treatise that became the Bible of French existentialism. In it, Sartre presents human existence as a constant project of creating meaning in an absurd, meaningless world. Drawing from phenomenology, he distinguished between être en soi, being in itself, the solid, self-contained existence of things, and être pour soi, being for itself, the fluid, negating consciousness of humans. The key idea, existence precedes essence. This means humans are not born with a predefined purpose or nature, essence. First, we simply exist, and then through our actions, we define who we are. We are radically free, and this freedom is both empowering and terrifying. Sartre described the unsettling feeling of this freedom as anguish, anxiety, the dread of realizing that nothing is holding you back from any choice except your own limitations and circumstances. And thus you bear full responsibility for your life. He illustrated this with the famous scenario. A man peering over a cliff feels not only fear of falling, but anguish at knowing he could choose to throw himself off. Similarly, we stand always on the brink of possibilities. Another of Sartre's famous concepts is bad faith, mauvaise foi. This is essentially self-deception when we pretend we're not as free as we are, often to avoid anxiety or responsibility. For instance, Sartre gives the example of a waiter who plays the role of waiter too rigidly, as if that's all he is, denying his transcendence, or a woman on a date who delays a decision by ignoring the implication of a man's hand holding hers, pretending she can treat it as just a physical thing separate from herself. In bad faith, we either act as pure facticity, just an object with set characteristics, or as pure transcendence, denying any facts about ourselves. Authenticity, the opposite of bad faith, is owning up to our freedom and the concrete conditions of our situation simultaneously. Life in post-war Paris. After the liberation of France, Sartre became a cultural superstar. He and Simone de Beauvoir founded a journal, Les Temps Modernes, which became an influential forum for intellectuals. Sartre wrote plays, like No Exit, with its famous line, "Hell is other people," meaning that much of our anguish comes from how others see us and fix us in their gaze. Novels, like Nausea, a fictional exploration of existential angst, and countless essays. He gave public talks that drew crowds of students and bohemians. Sartre's existentialism, emphasizing personal freedom, choice, and moral responsibility, resonated strongly in the disillusioned atmosphere after the war. In 1945, he gave a lecture titled "Existentialism is a Humanism" to clear up misconceptions. People were calling existentialism gloomy or amoral. Sartre argued it's actually an optimistic doctrine. It says our fate is in our hands. We create values through our choices. When he says humans are condemned to be free, he means we didn't ask for this freedom, but we can't avoid it. Even not choosing is a choice. Thus, we must take responsibility for all we do. This, Sartre claims, leads to a kind of humanist ethics. In choosing for ourselves, we are choosing an image of man. We implicitly will that our values be universal. That's a bit abstract, but basically he believed, if we honestly confront our freedom, we wouldn't choose in ways that we couldn't also will others to choose. Critics, like Camus or later Marxists, weren't wholly convinced by his ethics, but Sartre did attempt to work one out. As Sartre's fame grew, so did his political commitment. He became more and more engaged in leftist causes. In the late 1940s and 50s, he leaned toward Marxism, seeing it as addressing the social and economic structures that existentialism initially hadn't fully considered. In 1952, during the Cold War, Sartre visited the Soviet Union and for a time was somewhat naive about its reality, though he never joined the Communist Party and later criticized the USSR sharply when the horrors became undeniable. He took up activism, opposing French colonialism in Algeria and Indochina, supporting student protests in May 68, speaking out against the Vietnam War. He even co-chaired a war crimes tribunal condemning American actions alongside Bertrand Russell. He embraced the role of a left-wing gadfly, often putting himself at risk. The right-wing paramilitary OAS reportedly tried to bomb his apartment due to his support for Algerian independence. President de Gaulle, when pressed to arrest Sartre, famously said, "One does not imprison Voltaire," implying Sartre as a national treasure of free thought. Through all this, Sartre maintained a massive output of writing. In the 1960s, he produced a gargantuan biographical study of Gustave Le Bair, the family idiot, and continued writing on theater and cultural topics. His style and philosophy shifted more toward an attempt to integrate existentialism with Marxism, notably in Critique of Dialectical Reason, 1960, a dense work exploring the tension between individual agency and collective structures. Now to the Nobel Prize incident. In 1964, Sartre was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, officially for his rich ideas and philosophy expressed in literature. He had already in principle decided long ago he would refuse any official honor. He'd previously declined the Légion d'honneur. He saw such awards as turning the writer into an institution, compromising his independence. So, true to form, he refused the Nobel. The Nobel Committee was not pleased. It caused a stir. But Sartre insisted he didn't want to be enshrined or used by anyone, East or West. He also didn't want to have to align his future writings with what would be expected of a Nobel laureate. The gesture was controversial. Some thought it pretentious or ungrateful. Others admired his consistency. Either way, it cemented his legend as the existentialist who lived his philosophy. Personal life, Sartre and Beauvoir's open relationship and intellectual partnership were key to both. They championed each other's work. They had other lovers, some shared, some not. But their bond was central. They spent countless hours in Paris cafes discussing ideas, shaping each other's thoughts. Beauvoir, herself a great existentialist philosopher and pioneering feminist writer, sometimes gets overshadowed by Sartre in public memory. But she was just as brilliant and contributed significantly to Sartre's thinking, and vice versa. They were a powerhouse duo, emblematic of mid-20th century French intellectual life. Sartre's health declined in the 1970s. He had always lived somewhat hard. Lots of coffee and cigarettes, and drugs to stay awake during marathon writing sessions. Plus, he nearly lost his sight, possibly as a side effect of that wartime eye problem. He went blind toward the end. He also became something of a mentor to the radical left youth. He even symbolically edited the leftist paper Libération when he was almost 70. He died in April 1980 of a lung edema. 50,000 people reportedly attended his funeral in Paris, an incredible outpouring, more like what you'd expect for a rock star or head of state. It showed how much he had become the voice of a generation, or two, in France, the conscience of the left, the hero of individual freedom. Legacy. Sartre's legacy is multifaceted. Philosophically, terms like existential angst, bad faith, and existence precedes essence have entered common parlance far beyond academic philosophy. His vision of radical freedom and responsibility influenced not only philosophy, but psychology, existential therapy, for instance, and literature and film. Countless characters and plotlines wrestle with Sartrean choices. Existentialism became a cultural movement largely thanks to Sartre. After World War II, when existentialism spread, young people in Europe and America wore black, read Sartre and Camus, listened to jazz, and talked about authenticity and absurdity in cafes. It became almost a lifestyle. Sartre, ironically, disliked the fad aspect, but it happened. The idea that life is meaningless until we give it meaning is a baseline assumption for many today. Not a shocking revelation, as it was pre-Sartre. Sartre's political activism also left its mark. Though some of his stances are debated, critics say he was too indulgent of violent revolution at times, citing his statement that in an unjust society, violence by the oppressed is not only understandable but necessary. He set an example of the engaged intellectual. He believed philosophers can't isolate themselves in ivory towers. They must confront the world. This conception of the intellectual, speaking truth to power, getting involved in social causes, is very much alive in Europe and elsewhere. Whenever we see scholars or artists signing petitions, writing op-eds about wars or social issues, etc., we see a bit of Sartre's model. In literature, his novels and plays might not be as widely read now as in mid-20th century, but works like Nausea and No Exit remain in the canon as vivid illustrations of existentialist themes, the nausea of realizing the contingency and absurdity of existence. The idea that hell is other people, meaning we can be tortured by how others fix our identity. Though that line is often misinterpreted, as Sartre didn't think humans are inherently torturers to each other. Rather, he meant if relationships are based purely on trying to dominate or be validated by the other, it becomes hellish. Critiques of Sartre include that his early philosophy overemphasized individual choice and ignored the weight of social structures, something he tried to correct later by incorporating Marxism. Others criticize his later flirtation with Maoism around 1970 as naive. Camus famously fell out with Sartre, accusing him of justifying terror by supporting Stalinists. Their split is legendary, marking a fissure in existential humanism versus revolutionary politics. Both perspectives continue to be discussed. Nevertheless, Sartre's core message, that we are free and responsible, continues to inspire. In a world where it's easy to blame systems, genes, upbringing, Sartre provocatively asserts the role of personal commitment. Even if you're shaped by factors, at each moment you have to choose who to be in response. This ethos is empowering, but also sobering. You can't hide behind excuses. It resonates in everything from self-help rhetoric about choosing your life path to political calls for personal accountability in resisting oppression. Finally, there's an anecdote about Sartre during May 1968. When student protesters erected barricades, Sartre didn't throw stones, but he did go talk to them and write about them with understanding. President de Gaulle, though their politics differed, reputedly told his cabinet, "Sartre is France," meaning he was so emblematic of French thought that, like Voltaire or Hugo, he must be handled as a force in his own right. Sartre's funeral turnout confirms that sentiment. He had become a symbol of the free thinker. Today, more than 40 years after his death, Jean-Paul Sartre remains a towering figure in philosophy and literature. Whenever someone grapples with the idea that we must create our own meaning, or whenever an intellectual stands up to authority citing moral duty, Sartre's legacy is at work. In the preface to Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, Sartre wrote passionately about the necessity of anti-colonial violence in context. It was highly controversial, but it showed how far he was willing to go in aligning with the oppressed. That fervor, sometimes misguided, often profound, made him a hero to many, a villain to some, but ignored by none. In the end, whether one agrees with all his conclusions or not, Sartre achieved what he sought. He made people acutely aware of their freedom and their responsibility to use it. As he once said, "We are our choices." By that measure, his own life of bold, often risky choices stands as an example of living authentically according to one's beliefs. And that truly is an existentialist life well lived,